Well, let's pick up on that, Megan. What happens if somebody calls you and says, look, I'm having all these problems? And Frank mentioned drinking. You know, he's got these outbursts. There are periods where we don't talk. What should I do? Where do I go? Who do I seek as far as outside help? What kind of advice do you give somebody when they give you that phone call?
That's a great question, Mike. The role of the Military Family Network is to act as a liaison in connecting military service members and their families with trusted and expert resources. A lot of times, sometimes that's just redirecting them back to their military benefits and programs. There's some wonderful programs out there. As in most cases, it's just often sometimes difficult to get the word out. However, you do have families that, for one reason or another, you know, opt to make different decisions as far as, you know, whether or not they want to engage within the military or outside within the community for that type of assistance. And the Military Family Network strongly believes in empowering families so that they have the information that they need to make the best choices for themselves and their families. Our end goal is to ensure their well-being and to keep them strong. So when family or an individual would contact us with the type of question about, you know, that there are things going on and where can they turn, we try to provide ample resources so that they can make the selection for themselves. We never provide their information to others. We basically provide all of the information back to the individual and once again putting the ball in their court, allowing them to decide what route of assistance or inquiries or developing relationships they want to do. So some of the ones that we would, first of all, is approach the military resources. They can contact Military OneSource at www.militaryonesource.com. That's the military official program for providing family with program support and referrals. The other places that they can go are their family wellness and family support units. They can also go to their chaplains. And then, of course, there's the unit command channels, the medical channels, and the VA system. The Department of Veterans Affairs has opened up some of their programs now so that it's not just service member driven, but also includes counseling and programs for family members as well.
I'd like to come in at this point and just say a little bit about depression and about certain forms of anxiety, because these are, in a way, medical conditions where the brain isn't working the way it ought to, and things can go from bad to worse. For example, I have a very close family member who had a heart attack, and he called me up and said, my wife thinks I'm depressed. I don't think I am, but she says I am, and after a heart attack, depression can be dangerous. And if you look at the literature there, there is a threefold increase in the risk for another heart attack if you have depression after a heart attack. You have to treat that depression. You have to treat it aggressively. And there are people who come back from combat and they have depression. Think of depression as being a medical injury to the brain's mood thermostat. So instead of being sad when you should and happy when you should, something's gone wrong in that control mechanism, and you get stuck in a low mood place. And other things happen when you're depressed. You get a certain form of insomnia. You don't have the energy to do what you need to do. You start failing at a lot of tasks. Sometimes the depression is a bit subtle. But a wife would see that, and it's important to treat depression. So that's one thing to be on the lookout for. And even if there's some stigma involved, I would advise a family member, if you see depression in your spouse, be as assertive as you can be in getting help for it. And we're not talking about just being a bit moody or having some down days. We're talking about a condition in which you are down more days than not, where you feel hopeless, helpless, worthless, and you lack the energy to do what you have to do. That is a psychiatric and a medical disease. Treat it.
Well, you know what, Frank, let me just jump in here for a minute. I had a medical condition years ago, and I waited and waited and waited before I went to the doctor, and the doctor said, you know, I can't believe you waited this long. But I think that's a typical guy response. And, you know, we're talking about the strong, silent types. And these are guys who've been in leadership positions in many cases, and they don't want to, and you're talking about stigma. In many respects, it's that they're acknowledging some sort of weakness or impediment. That's how they see it. How do you get them past that hurdle to say, no, this is actually strength, walking up and asking for help when you need it? Because you mentioned it, Frank, this is a medical condition.
Absolutely. You know, and I try different ways when I'm involved in helping somebody get the help that they need. I could say, you know, think of yourself as a professional athlete, and the team doctor needs to be sure that you are in tip-top shape. Being psychologically sharp is just as important as being in shape in cardiovascular conditioning. So for those who take pride in their body and their physical aptitude, you can make the case, well, I can, I'm a medical doctor. So I try to make the case on medical grounds. You know, when it comes to post-traumatic stress disorder, we are still fighting to have the country realize that PTSD is real. It's as medical as having an injury to your kidney. And you have to get that important organ, the brain, back on track. So I can't, Mike, give the formula to get the horse to water and get the horse to drink. I can just say that in each case, we have to realize it's important. You do trial and error. Sometimes it takes a village. You have to think of who else is in your own personal village. If a wife can't get her husband, who is depressed, to see his doctor, maybe she talks to his dad and his dad is able to do it. But you don't let a serious psychiatric illness progress.
Megan, let me talk to you a little bit more about families. Because, you know, when somebody's deployed and they come back, you talked about the issues of the family having to get on with things and how they respond. But in many cases, there's a ripple effect, and the impact can be felt by the children. And this one comes from a mother who's very frustrated. You know, the teenage kids, they're acting out, the grades are slipping, there may be drugs involved. How can I intervene without sending my child further away? So you've got the issue of they're dealing with the spouse who's done the deployment, but you're also dealing with the kids and how they're acting out as a result of all of this. What advice do you give to them, Megan?
Well, unfortunately, the parent that stays behind usually takes on the angst and any anger that may be directed, towards the parent that's leaving. And as a result, there is a lot of stress within the house because you're down to a single parent household anyway. And if there are other smaller children as well in the home, then you've really got a parent who's doing more than double duty. The military and a lot of outside organizations have recognized that there has been in the past a previous gap in support for teens. And there are some great programs and organizations now that are in play. Certainly the Military Child Education Coalition has been, it's a nonprofit that focuses on involving the schools in helping them to understand their military students and in connecting them with peer groups so that others can work with them and support them. But certainly this is a challenge. We hear it often, and any advice that Frank can give would be greatly welcomed, I'm sure.
Well, Megan, I'm concerned about the families that are out in rural America where the dad who's away has been deployed by the National Guard, and they don't live close to a base. So Can I ask you about that? Is there some form of outreach to those parts of America where you don't have the presence of the VA or the regular military facility?
Well, that I think is part of the involvement of the community, and the Military Child Education Coalition is working within the schools, and certainly that would be able to be a support in rural areas where families are living remotely from military installations, where there may be more official or formal programs of support. The other aspect of that is that the military has done quite a bit of outreach into the communities and organizations like ours as well in trying to connect families and children with programs like I know of a number of camps for children of deployed service members where they can be connected with other children or teens like themselves so that they can share their experiences together.
Well, that's useful, and I think we want to publicize the phone numbers, the web addresses, so that more and more people are aware of those resources. I do consult from time to time in schools, and the Michigan Victim Alliance has an outreach program for teenagers in high schools, and we're doing it retail. We're going to one school at a time and trying to develop a whole day when important issues are discussed and the kids feel they are empowered and they talk about the things that they usually are discussing among themselves, but now the teachers are allowed to listen and people from the community come in. I know as a parent and a grandparent that you do need to be in touch with the school when your kids are going to school. And you can find that there are teachers who are more responsive. There sometimes is a principal who really wants to listen to you if there's a special problem. But here again, it takes some confidence on the part of the parent, some trial and error until you find the people at your child's school who really show the interest in you and in your child personally and are willing to collaborate.
And I don't think we should overlook also the faith-based community. A number of church groups and organizations, you know, provide support. And also the veteran service organizations that have posts and chapters within the local community also do an outstanding job of connecting with those that are on active duty or part of, you know, the reserves and called up so that they can also support their families.
I think that's very important, Megan. And it comes back to this phrase, it takes a village. It does. What we're trying to do in this conversation is help people who feel a little bit neglected or they haven't found the way to rally the support network for themselves. And if the person who needs support is a teenage son who is behaving in ways that you as his mom don't like, and you think it is connected to the fact that his dad is on his fourth or fifth deployment, you know, what can you do? Well, part of what you need to do is get a sense of who is out there in your church, in his school, in your extended family, and who can play a role in helping this troubled boy feel supported, confident, understood, and instead of having his energy come out in destructive ways, it's put to use. Athletics are often a very, very important issue, and we can't expect every coach to be fully informed and understanding, but there's another resource.
You know, I want to get to a question that's here because I think it's a really good one. And Megan, you've talked a lot about, and Frank, you have too, about how far we've come since the Vietnam era and the fact that the military is cognizant that there can be issues out there. They're working with the families and that sort of thing. So let me start with you, Megan. This one comes from somebody who says, being briefed on the symptoms and behaviors of combat stress and PTSD is not the same as living with them. I think I know what's going on, but now what do I do?
Well, I think there are a couple issues here. I think Frank brings up one when he talked about depression. I think there are symptoms that look like other symptoms or, you know, can belong to different issues. I remember when my cousin was going through medical school and was learning about the different ailments, and he said each one of the students in the classroom were saying, well, I'm tired, I have that, I've got this, I've got that, and working themselves up into a hypochondria frenzy. And I'm not suggesting that there's hypochondria here. I'm just suggesting that there's a misinterpretation from a layman's perspective of being able to understand when is depression a part of PTSD? When is it just a part of combat stress, or when is it just depression? You know, how deep is depression, or when it, you know, is it just a blue mood? You know, if you're having regular normal reintegration issues of coming home, you know, so that there's a separation. You know, that type of thing where, you know, your sleeping is disturbed or so forth. And when now does it fall, you know, off of the normal spectrum and into the abnormal or the concerned spectrum? And I think that these are the subtleties that the family members are dealing with. So, you know, they really have been brought up to date on what they may be able to expect. And we have to keep in mind that this really only affects a small portion of the overall, you know, military population.
And what I hear also, Megan and Mike, in this question is, I know about these conditions. That doesn't really help me deal with them. And I think that would be analogous to saying I've read a book about bowling or about tennis or golf, but that doesn't mean I know how to play the game or I know how to get a strike or drive off the tee. So what do you do once you know the general lay of the land to improve your game? Now, there have been times when I've felt quite privileged to work with a family member, and that's the issue. And then what goes on is week after week, they're debriefing with me about what came up, what they did, what they thought of doing. And I'm trying to be the coach. Well, sounds like you hit that one right. Or boy, we know you really missed that one. But it all has to be specific. It has to be related to that individual's situation and the options that they see that are available to them as a coach for a next of kin, where that person doesn't have PTSD, but their loved one does. Sometimes I'll tell you, a professional can be of a great deal of assistance. Let's say, for example, the issue is triggers for flashbacks. The wife wants to watch a comedy show, but in the comedy show, there's gunfire, and the husband isn't ready for that. Maybe that means it's a good idea to see the whole movie through yourself in advance and be sure there aren't going to be triggers, so you get it right next time.
Frank, can I ask you a question?
Yes.
When you're talking about triggers, is it obvious to the individual what those triggers, in other words, the individual who may be suffering from triggers, is it obvious to them what those triggers are, or are they generalized, or do they happen in a way subconsciously and I don't know. Let's.
Well, I hear you, Megan. And the answer to every one of those possibilities is yes. Sometimes the trigger is extremely obvious. There's a dad who saw his 20-year-old daughter crushed between a car that she was washing and a charity car wash and a huge Coca-Cola truck, and there was nothing he could do. Thank goodness the daughter survived. She's seriously injured. He's got PTSD. She doesn't. Every time he sees a truck that size, it's a trigger. That's a very specific trigger. Working with a guy who's a football coach, he was run over by a snowplow. His triggers are very, very specific. But then there's a whole other part of post-traumatic stress where, in general, your anxiety response is released. Many, many false alarms. And there, it's not a trigger. It's just the fact that something has been shifted in your whole body physiology. So sometimes we choose to treat with minor tranquilizers or actually with antidepressants, and we can restore a normal baseline for being sent into an anxious state. But I would say PTSD has both generalized lowered threshold for anxiety and very, very specific triggers. Sometimes those triggers are subliminal, say an anniversary reaction. That means that without looking at the calendar, you feel it in your bones. Your body remembers. Comes that time of year, or let's say for combat vets who've been in a particular theater of action, there may be dust in the air. There may be a sound that sounds like a call to prayer, and it takes them back. And without realizing it, they move into flashback mode. So it could be any of those. I think what we're asking the spouse to consider is do your best. You won't be perfect. But as long as you're trying, you know deep in your heart you've done your homework. You're doing your best to be the partner who shares the burden.
Okay, so if I'm a spouse and I've triggered the flashback, what do I do?
Well, I think you apologize. Yeah, it's great if the relationship is good enough so that eventually you can use humor, tenderness, you know, various ways to recover the regard. But I know we're talking about situations that are far from perfect, where the spouse feels he or she is just walking around on eggshells and, oh, my God, there I did it again. And then the spouse has a problem as well. Best way to deal with these problems is really common sense. It's when the time is right, you talk it over. You know, the best thing would be to have the person with PTSD tell the spouse who doesn't have PTSD, here's what I'd like you to do if you find me moving toward an unwanted re-experience. Some spouses will say, I really want you to get in my face. I want you to tell me, hey, it's 2009 or 2010. It's not back then, and you're here with me in America. Some people like that. Others would say, I'd rather handle it myself. If you see me go in there, please just leave me alone. I'll be better in a little while. So in the best of all possibilities, you find the time to talk it out, you get your marching orders, and then you follow through.
Frank and Megan, believe it or not, this time has just flown by. I want to thank both of you for joining me today. Any final thoughts to leave with the listeners briefly? Megan, why don't we start with you? Anything you want to impart to our listeners?
Well, I think the most important thing from our discussion today, and certainly from Frank's expert advice, is that don't try and figure this out in a vacuum. Talk to your spouse. Even if they're the quiet, silent type, they have information that they can share with you that can help you to take the information that the military has prepared you with and implement that more successfully into your home.
And I would add, Mike, we're talking about problems that happen with a frequency of maybe 1 in 4 that a spouse coming home is going to have an adjustment that requires some attention. However, 3 out of 4 don't need this. So we don't want to overstate the problem. We don't want to set something up in America where, as happened in the Vietnam era, there was a general feeling that when you came back from the Vietnam War, you were an emotional cripple. That's not the case. We want to be mature about it and comforting, and we really need to become an American family and reach out to one another, share our experiences, our skills. The civilian world has to help because the military world is doing the best that it can, but its resources are stretched. So if you're a teacher, a clergyman, a general physician, a good friend, a good neighbor, you've got a role to play also.
Mike, I'd like to leave the audience as well with some helpful resources. Gift from Within is located at www.giftfromwithin.org. Joyce Boaz is the executive director and has done a fine job of providing support and access to information for military families and others who have been victims and survivors of trauma. Of course, there's the Military Family Network, and if you can't find information anywhere else, please give us a call, and we'll do our best to connect you with the services that you need. You can find us at www.militaryfamilynetwork.com. As I mentioned in our discussion today, there's Military OneSource, which is the military's official support services. It's at www.militaryonesource.com. And some additional information provided by the military on PTSD, questions and answers, frequently asked questions, and those sorts of things, some great videos. Defense Centers of Excellence at www.dcoe.health.mil or pdhealth.mil, Deployment Health Clinical Center. This is also an excellent resource for the community and clinicians. It is at www.pdhealth.mil. And of course, the Department of Veterans Affairs, www.va.gov. And as Frank has suggested, they've been working now with post-traumatic stress disorder and other combat injuries for many, many years, and have a specialty in that field.
I want to thank our guest, noted psychiatrist, trauma specialist, and founder of Gift From Within, Dr. Frank Ochberg, and also Megan Turek, the executive vice president of the Military Family Network. Check out the website at www.militaryfamilynetwork.com. I would also like to thank Joyce Boaz and Gift From Within. Check out their website at www.giftfromwithin.org. And we'd also like to thank you, the listener. Please let us know what you think of our program, and if you have ideas for future podcasts, we want to hear from you. Until next time, I'm your host, Mike Walsh.